Chapter 54. After 8 hours into the congressional committee hearing, Curtis Merlin Zale was staring frequently at his watch and fidgeting nervously in his chair. He was not the supremely confident man who had faced Congresswoman Smith and her committee members earlier. The smug grin on his face was also gone, replaced by lips tensed and pressed tightly together. Word from Omo Kanai and late-breaking reports of a disaster in New York should have reached the hearing room hours earlier. Congressman William August from Oklahoma was in the midst of questioning Zale about the rising prices charged by the oil company refineries when Sandra DeLage, wearing a tailored business dress, approached Curtis from behind and laid a paper on his desk. He excused himself before answering August and scanned the paper's contents. His eyes suddenly widened, and he looked up at DeLage. Her face was as grim as a mortician's. He placed his hand over his microphone and asked several hushed questions, which she answered in a voice too low for anyone sitting nearby to hear. Then she turned and left the proceedings. Zale was not a man easily shaken by defeat, but at this moment he looked like Napoleon after Waterloo. "I'm sorry," he murmured to August. "Could you repeat the question?" Lauren was tired. Late afternoon had become early evening, but she was not about to let Zale leave the committee hearings. Not yet. Her aides had kept her informed on the operation to stop the Pacific Trojan and the fact that no demolition charges had been found. Not until 2 hours later was she alerted to the mission to stop the Mongol invader. She had heard nothing from Pitt or Sandecker since 2 o'clock, and had fought a nagging fear during the following 4 hours. Her anxiety was made worse by a cold anger directed at Zale, who resolutely fired back calculated answers to their questions without hesitation or claims of faulty memory. To the reporters covering the hearings, it looked as if he was in perfect control and steering the proceedings to fit his own agenda. Laura knew Zale was tiring too, and she forced patience on herself. She was waiting like a lioness in ambush for the right moment to strike with the damaging information given by Sally Morse. She pulled the papers containing the questions and accusations she had prepared from her briefcase and waited patiently until Congressman August had finished his line of questioning. At that moment, she noticed the faces in the audience suddenly stare behind her. Whispers began circulating throughout the chamber. Then a hand touched her shoulder. She turned and found herself gazing up incredulously into the face of Dirk Pitt. He was dressed in dirty jeans and a wrinkled sweatshirt. He looked exhausted, as if he had just climbed a mountain. His hair was a tangled mess, and his face sported a 3-day growth of black stubble. A security guard was clutching his arm, trying to drag him from the chamber, but he pulled the guard along with him like a stubborn St. Bernard. "Dirk," she whispered, "what are you doing here?" He didn't look at her as he answered, but stared with a smug grin at Zale and spoke in a voice that carried across the room through her microphone. "We stopped the liquid natural gas tanker from blowing up New York Harbor. The ship now rests on the bottom of the sea. Please inform Mr. Zale that his entire Viper team went down with the ship, and it is now safe for Ms. Sally Morse, the CEO of Yukon Oil, to testify before your committee without fear of reprisal." Then Pitt, in what might have looked like an accidental motion, lightly brushed his hand against Lauren's auburn hair and exited the chamber. A vast load was suddenly lifted from Lauren's shoulders. She said, "Ladies and gentlemen, it is getting late, and if there is no objection, I would like to adjourn this hearing until 9 o'clock tomorrow, when I will call an important witness to testify who will reveal the truth behind Mr. Zale's criminal activities." "Rather strong words, don't you think?" interrupted Congressman Sturgis. "We have seen or heard nothing here that shows evidence of any criminal activity." "You will tomorrow," Lauren said evenly, staring at Sturgis with a look of sheer triumph. when Ms. Morse will supply the names of everyone in Washington and across the rest of the country who has accepted bribes from Mr. Curtis Merlin Zale. I promise you, the trail of graft and corruption, the depth of the money trail into offshore bank accounts, will stun the government to its core and shock the public as no scandal ever has in the past. "What has this Sally Morse got to do with Mr. Zale?" asked Sturgis, realizing too late he was skating on thin ice. "She was a former member of the Cerberus Inner Council. She kept a written record of meetings, payoffs, and crimes. There are many names on the list you should find familiar." The ice cracked and parted, and Sturgis fell through. He abruptly rose and left the chamber without another word as Lauren banged her gavel and adjourned the proceedings until the following day. The gallery went mad. Reporters from the major news media surged around Zale and rushed after Lauren. But Pitt was waiting at the door and hustled her through the noisy mob of news people who were shouting questions and trying to block their path. With his arm around her waist, he managed to steer her through the gauntlet and down the steps of the Capitol into a Numa car waiting at the curb. Giordino stood by the car with the doors open. Curtis Merlin Zale sat at the table, inundated by a sea of journalists and flashing cameras, like a man lost in the abyss of a nightmare. Finally, he rose unsteadily to his feet and fought his way through the turmoil. With the help of Capitol Police, he made it to the safety of his limousine. His chauffeur drove him to the mansion that housed the Washington headquarters of Cerberus, and then watched as Zale walked like an elderly senior citizen through the lobby and entered the elevator to his luxurious office. No man was more isolated from reality. He had no close friends, no family still living. Omo Kanai, perhaps the only man to whom Zale could relate, was dead. Zale was alone in a world where his was a household name. As he sat there behind his desk and stared out the window into the courtyard below, he weighed his future and found it ominously dark. It was inevitable that he would end up in federal prison regardless of how long he fought to stay free. When the members of the Cerberus cartel turned against him to save themselves, the finest, most expensive criminal trial lawyers in the country would be fighting a battle lost before it had even begun. Their testimony alone was enough to ensure his execution. His wealth would surely be taken away by an avalanche of lawsuits, federal as well as civil. His loyal team of vipers was no more. They were lying deep in the silt of New York's Outer Bay. They no longer stood ready to eliminate those who would testify against him. He could never escape, never hide anywhere in the world. A man of his stature was too easy for investigators to track down, whether he fled to the Sahara Desert or to a lonely island in the middle of the ocean. The people who had died because of his greed came back to haunt him now, not as wraiths or hideous ghosts, but like a parade of ordinary people thrown on a screen by a projector. In the end, he had lost his great gamble. He saw no avenue leading to a refuge. The decision was not difficult. He rose from behind his desk, walked to a bar, and poured himself a shot of expensive 50-year-aged whiskey and sipped it as he returned to his desk and opened a side drawer. He picked up what looked like a small antique snuff box. There were two pills inside that he had saved in the unlikely event he would be incapacitated from an accident or suffered from a debilitating disease. He took a final drink of the whiskey, placed the pills under his tongue, and relaxed in the big leather executive chair. They found Curtis Merlin Zale dead the next morning, his desk clean of papers. There was no final note expressing shame or regret.